beyond the headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight Segment, where your questions and comments matter. At 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight Segment. I'm Harold Fisher.
We know that black victims make up the majority of the people who are killed or who are murdered in the United States of America. And yet they also have much less of the likelihood to see their murderers arrested than a white victim.
That's reporter Wesley Lowry of The Washington Post, the lead reporter behind an expansive investigative article about murder and black victims in America. It's titled Murder with Impunity and Unequal Justice. It looks at why blacks are murdered more than whites in America, but their crimes are less likely to be solved. Joining me to talk about this are Ron Hampton. He's a member of Blacks on Law Enforcement of America, as well as the co-convener of the D.C. Justice Collaborative. Also, April Rain, creator of Oscar So White and senior director for Fractured Atlas. Also, Ngozi Ndolue, she is the senior director of criminal justice programs with the NAACP. Join this conversation. We want to know what you think about this issue. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Thank you all for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
April, are you there?
I am. Thank you for having me.
Wonderful. I'm going to start with you, but first I want to start with the numbers. And this is what Wesley Lowry told me earlier today.
Taken every murder in more than 50 cities going back a decade. Now, of those, 26,000 of the murders have gone unsolved, without anyone ever being arrested for the murder. Of those 26,000, 18,600 of the victims were black. So three-quarters of the unsolved homicides in these cities had black victims. Police make an arrest in about 63% of murders in which the victim is white, but just 47% of murders where the victim is black. And that is true across almost every one of the 50 cities, where almost no matter where you live in a major city in the United States of America, a black murder victim is less likely to see their killer arrested than a white murder victim.
April, your response to not only what Wesley just shared with us regarding the numbers, but this article overall, are you surprised?
No, I'm not surprised at all. Wesley is a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter, and so I take what he says as gospel because he really has dedicated the last couple of lives and even a couple of books, I believe, at this point, to policing in this country. And so I absolutely believe the very stark numbers that he has provided to us. The question now is what do we do? You know, we know what the problem is. We know what the issues are, but what are the solutions? As the article points out, one of the issues is a lack of trust among community members, among black and brown residents in this country, with respect to law enforcement. And part of that is based on fact. You know, what we see is very often in social media where it appears that law enforcement officers are using excessive force for, in some cases, no reason at all. And so, yes, there is going to be a lack of trust among law enforcement officers and community members. And then that means that if you have seen something, if you could be a potential witness, you may not be willing to come forward. In addition, as was pointed out in the Washington Post article, residents in the Southwest and those in California, especially brown residents, Latinx residents, may fear deportation concerns, whether they are legal citizens here or not, because we have seen ICE, in fact, take away some people who are U.S. citizens. And so, again, there's going to be a distrust of law enforcement officials. But really, the onus can't be on the victims or the potential victims. It must be on law enforcement officials to do better, to make more inroads within the community, perhaps to live and work in the communities that they serve.
Well, April, before you give away my entire show... Let me bring Ron in here to talk about some of this, because, you know, Ron, you're retired. You spent decades on the streets here in D.C. Are the issues brought out by the article and April just now, are they still as relevant now as they were when you were on the streets?
Yes, sir. That's very true. They are. And as a matter of fact, there's been a steady erosion of the trust and confidence that our community and the Hispanic community had in the police. There's been a steady erosion of that for in the last decade. And now with this administration and its policies, we're seeing even more erosion of that trust and confidence that you need. See, it's more than just, do we trust the police? Do we have a relationship? It's a variety of things. For them, if you take the notion that that the police is a representative of some of the social services in our community, then why would the community trust them when they come to do that? And so there's been this backing up a kind of effect, because the police haven't proven that they are really sincere about building a relationship to facilitate the kind of solution to the problems that we see in our community. So it's really complex, but there's a simple answer to the whole issue.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We're talking about the Washington Post article, Murder with Impunity and Unequal Justice, looking at why more blacks are murdered in the United States, and yet their crimes are less likely to be solved. If you have a question, if you have a comment about this Washington Post article or the issues that are brought forth by it, please share in this conversation at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. What do you believe, Ngozi, that this is about a Black Lives Matter thing, or is it perhaps in some communities people may feel that Black lives don't matter?
I think it's absolutely about the value that we place on Black lives. And this is one statistic that's part of a whole spectrum of statistics that shows us that as a society, which is something that we don't necessarily need a statistic to know. We have our lived lives, right? But that as a society that we don't value Black pain in the same way. So we can see this from the disparities about what happens with homicide victims. We can see this about the missing people, the over 64,000 missing Black women and children, and the disproportionate number of the people on the National Missing Children's Index that are Black. We can also see that in the hospitals, where we're seeing that Black pain literally is not valued the same way as white pain, so you're not getting as effective pain management. We can see this in schools, when we're seeing that when Black children are in classrooms, that their behavior is being seen more disruptive as more of a problem. So basically, I think that this issue is a criminal justice issue, is a police issue, but overall, it's a broader societal issue. It's about how we see Black people in America. And we know this is just one more kind of information point that our lives aren't valued in the same way. So we have a lot of work in front of us to actually change that dynamic, because it's been here since the beginning.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Let's go to Ray. Ray, calling from North Carolina. Ray, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm just concerned about the issue that we are having, because we are doing so much damage to each other. And why should we, why are they having a issue about something that we need to be having an issue with? Because we're doing too much, so much to each other. And it's aggravating to me to just sit down and watch TV, and the only thing on the news is somebody black done something.
Ray, let me stop you there because I'm not discounting your point that certainly black on black crime is a very, very critical issue. But the conversation tonight is about finding justice and closure for victims' families after these crimes happen, and what role law enforcement, the justice system, and communities need to play in that. And so certainly, if you want to speak specifically to that issue, I'll let you finish your point. Go right ahead. Go ahead.
I lost my train of thought.
Well, that's all right. If you think about it, give me a call back. Please, go right ahead.
I wanted to just jump in because I think that those pieces about the way that we look at violence in our communities and the way that the crimes are not being prosecuted are related. So, and I think the term that you use, black on black crime, is a really great example of this. You know, when's the last time we've heard of the term white on white crime? I've never heard that other than when I'm trying to make this point, which is basically that most crime is intra-racial, right? We
Absolutely.
Live near black people. Definitely. We aren't going to schools with black people. We have a pretty still segregated world. So the crime that is committed is committed with people who are close to us. So, but we have this kind of construct where we are seeing, black people are seen as more criminal, as more dangerous, and that because of that construct, we actually have less of a focus on solving the issues of community violence, of treating it as a public health issue, which it is, because we know for black men and boys, that young men and boys, that homicide is a leading cause of death, right? So we must address that, and we can care about that. We can care about police violence. We can care about the justice that is given to people who whose family members have been killed all at the same time. So we need to be working on all fronts, and it's all related.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. April, I want you and then Ron to talk about this, and we're going to lose you, April, in a few minutes. I know you have to go, but please talk to me about this snitches get stitches mantra that we've heard for so many years, and what part that may play in unsolved crimes where African Americans are the victims.
Yeah, I think that it's a trope that really needs to be retired at this point, right? So if you are in a gang, I guess, or related gang activity, then yes, that phrase is used. Snitches get stitches, meaning, you know, if you see that something that happens, you better shut up, or, you know, we're going to retaliate against you, and so don't tell the cops what you know. But I think it's different if you are a community member and your community is suffering because of the violence that is occurring within that community, and you know something that is going to put a mother or a wife or a father's heart at ease. Then yes, you absolutely should stand up. For example, we would never say, with respect to the Trayvon Martin killing, that no one should come forward if they've seen something, even though it was right there within that community, right? So we need to really think about what we're saying, when we tell people not to cooperate. There are some concerns, of course, because there are times when, you know, you give the information that you know, and then the law enforcement says, well, how do you know that? And then somehow you get implicated because you've come forward and tried to do the right thing.
But hold on, April, and this is where I want Ron to come in, because it could be suggested in the case of Makaya Wilson, who was killed a couple of weeks ago, that police have said that shooting of those four young men in that community, that was not a random act. That was supposed to be retaliation. And so somebody in that community knows what happened. And it's easy to say if you live outside of that community. But if you live inside that community, there is a real fear, isn't there, Ron?
It is a real fear, but it also has to do with how we see each other and value what it is that we see in each other. And when we've lost value, and we have, I mean, young people have lost value. It's a different value statement today than it was in my community, because we didn't allow those kind of things. We didn't participate in it. So talking to the police, but that was a different police. There was a different value that existed. So you really had to take in consideration there is a danger factor that's associated with it, but you reduce the danger when you participate in the process of public safety in your community. So those folk that saw something have to say something, because it's a universal safety factor, not just about one or two young people. It's about the whole community. But but they're suffering from a value deficit that exists in them and in that whole community. So it's a variety of things that's creating the problems that we're having in our community. But that don't mean that we should not address it, because we can address it. Now, there are actually organizations and individuals in that community working to alleviate some of those problems about, it's nothing wrong with talking to the police and giving them information about getting those kind of people out of our community.
I want to talk a little bit more about that, but I need to take a break, and I also need to thank April Rain for participating in the year. Oh, she is going to say, wonderful, wonderful. Well, good. We do get to hear a little bit more from April after 7:30. We're also going to hear from you, our listeners, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Jeff Brown is next with the original Quiet Storm on 96.3 WHUR. More of this conversation in just a few seconds on Sirius XM, Channel 141.
The Howard University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 HD2, student-run WHBC HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, SiriusXM Channel 142, HBCU, and SiriusXM Channel 141, HUR Voices, Washington.
On the one hand, one thing police and prosecutors point to very often is that some cases are just harder to solve than others. For example, if you are shot by someone who you do not know personally, whether that's a drive-by shooting or maybe something that's gang or drug-related, that can be more difficult than, say, a domestic violence murder where a husband kills his wife. And we know statistically that these murders aren't spread out evenly or randomly across different racial groups. Some racial groups are more likely to be killed in one type of killing than another. On the other hand, one thing that the police also say, and the community leaders say very often, is that, you know, so much of solving crime is about cooperatively, crime like a homicide. Someone knows who did it. Someone has information. And there's a question of will that person be willing to provide that information to police, or will they not? And so what ends up happening is there's a cycle. You know, Black Americans have a long, historic distrust of the police that is well earned because of, you know, in many cases, historic injustices enacted or carried out by the police. There's a lack of trust, which makes these communities, often who are dealing with more violence than other communities, unlikely to cooperate with the police. That's combined with a fear of retaliation. And so what happens is some of these homicides don't get solved. Well, when you don't solve homicides, it creates a cycle.
That is reporter Wesley Lowry of The Washington Post, the lead reporter behind the investigative article about murder and Black victims in America, murder with impunity and unequal justice. It looks at why African Americans are murdered more than whites in America and why those crimes are less likely to be solved. We are continuing this conversation on Sirius XM Channel 141. Of course, this is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. My guests are Ron Hampton. He's a member of Blacks in Law Enforcement of America. Also on the phone, April Rain, co-creator of Oscar So White, and Ngozi Ndulue. She is the Senior Director of Criminal Justice Programs with the NAACP. Wesley said a lot in that last piece, but I think that many of the points that he was making are very, very important. Ngozi, talk to me a little bit about African Americans and their difficult history with police and how it is impacting things today.
Oh, it's absolutely impacting, I mean, a lot of portions of our daily lives. There actually have been studies about kind of the trauma people have undergone and what that means as far as just anxiety walking around day to day, driving day to day. This is not going to be new to your listeners when you are worried about what could happen if a cop pulled you over. You're worried about if you walk past a police officer in the street. So we know that from historically, the issues between law enforcement, the state sanctioned violence and mob violence, there's been a real tie. So if we think about, I think the Equal Justice Initiative's lynching memorial does such a powerful job of telling that story. But when we think about lynchings, that we think often about just general lynch mobs, but there needed to be at the least law enforcement complicity and usually some law enforcement involvement for that to happen. So we can see kind of how that racial history has impacted where the law enforcement officers who you would go to today to ask for protection or if you needed something were the people that tomorrow, if something went wrong, could be the people that were involved in violence against you. And, you know, lynching is an extreme example, but we've seen this. We see this day to day throughout the country. Now with all of these kind of cell phone videos and the kind of the prominence that this issue has come to after Michael Brown and the police involved deaths continue, we know that those videos, the things that we've seen, are not things that are new or have happened just lately, right? This is part of the long history of violence, police violence
Real quick, because I want to go to the phone, but go right ahead, and then I need to get to April
also. No, I was going to just give you an example. If you have a store in your community and the store sells bad products and you go in the store and recognize that the products are bad, you not only don't go back in the store, but then you begin to tell other people about the bad products that exist in the store. And that's what has happened around public safety and policing in our community. It's been a bad product. The results of policing, law enforcement, not necessarily public safety in a general sense, in a holistic sense, but it's been bad. So people talk to other people about it, and then that whole, their attitude about, they don't see that as something that can help them. That only takes place in the white community where we see the police as somebody to help us versus somebody that's going to hurt us. And then you talk about that in a sense to other people. So it's common knowledge now that that takes place, and that's what we're up against.
Let me go to Sean, calling from D.C. Sean, go right ahead. What's on your mind?
Oh, it's so many factors. I could start with my first experience with the Metropolitan Police Department, where I got to meet beat officers that paid respect to the people on the community and on the block. I never sold drugs or anything like that. And then I went to another jurisdiction, and I had a white officer ask me, how fast can I run the 50-yard dash? Meaning that you're going to plan to shoot me in the back. I'm not running away from you. But saying all of that to say that different territories in this country have different police departments. And when you look at D.C. specifically, and that's what I would like to talk about, is the fact that our current chief Newsom, I first met him when he was a lieutenant.
Sean, I've got a lot of folks on the phone. Please quickly make your point. I got a lot of folks that I need to get to.
Not all police are bad. With regard to that young girl that got killed in Clay Terrace, the first time I met him, he was in Clay Terrace.
Mm-hmm.
He holstered his weapon, put it in the trunk of the squad car, and played basketball with the community. Mm-hmm. And they fouled and hacked him to death.
Mm-hmm.
He played through and got the respect of the community.
Okay.
So, you know, with the things that folks are saying with regard to MPD and D.C., they're really trying to do their best.
Okay. Well, Sean, thank you so much for your comment, which brings me back to April. The point in the story was that in the Washington Post investigative story is that they looked at several dozen cities, and there seemed to be a common thread that there were more Black people killed and fewer cases solved. And certainly, as Sean just said, April, yes, not all police officers are bad. There are some bad apples that make the whole bunch look bad, but there are a lot of bad trees apparently in every city. And that, I think, is the thing that the article is trying to address. Your thoughts about that? Why is this happening everywhere?
Because there is systemic oppression.
and racism everywhere. That's the short answer. Because, you know, we have to remember, Sister was talking about lynching. You know, some of those folks took off their white robes and put on their police uniforms put on their judges' robes and put on their, you know, their lawyer suits. You know, and so the Klansmen, racism, races have always walked among us. And so if there is not systemic change from the top down, from the chief of police or whomever is at the top of that particular department on down through the youngest rookie, then there will be no change. You know, I take Sean's point very well that there needs to be community policing, right? That means that people, you know, in Oakland, there is a movie, Blind Spotting, that's out now, and they talked about the fact that they are bringing people in from other communities to work in the Oakland Police Department. Well, if you don't know the community,
right,
then you may not give the benefit of the doubt to that young black kid who's running down the street, and you may think that he has stolen something because of your implicit bias, as opposed to just thinking that he's on his way to meet his homies at the basketball court. Right. So there, it makes a difference, the connection that you have to the community. And that can only come after years and years of interaction, because trust is something that is earned. It is not immediate, especially when we have, as Sister said, we have so many of these cell phone videos showing police doing things that appear to be excessive. Then, you know, how do you rebuild the trust? It has to start from ground zero. And so that needs to happen over and over again throughout this country.
And I would like to just say it's so great that April's on this call, because I think, first of all, I will plug our Pathways to Police Reform Community Mobilization Toolkit, because I think there are a lot the communities can do around policing.
And before you continue, where can you find that?
On the NAACP.org website.
Okay, NAACP.org. Please go ahead, finish
Thank
your point.
You. Yeah. But I think that the work that April's doing, that the work that is being doing broadly, April talked about implicit bias. That's not just in policing, that's throughout our society. Sure. It's in our school. It's all of us. And it's not just white people, too, because there are a majority of black people who also have implicit bias against African Americans. And that seeps into everything. So, and that is created by the culture that we're living in. And that seeps into how we are subconsciously acting around the value of black lives in all sectors. So I think we have the work has to be as broad as culture. And we need to also be talking about economic opportunity, the way that our neighborhoods we're actually building up these neighborhoods, or are we sucking and leeching resources out of them by these tough on crime policies that people are trying to throw us back into in the war on drugs? So this is a big picture question, and we need to be addressing it with multifaceted solutions that are about education, about economics, media, etc.
Emmanuel calling from DC. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, I'm Emmanuel.
Yes, go right ahead. Turn your radio down. What's on your mind?
Okay, I'll make it quick. I think that there should be consequences and repercussions to the unjustifiable murders of black and brown people.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is, if you unjustifiably kill a person, not just a person of color, but a person, and it's unjustifiable, you lose your job, you lose your pension, you will go to jail. That will disrupt their family also, like it disrupts ours when we lose a family member unjustifiably, you know, instead of getting paid leave and to go through all the whitewash of.
Oh, you're talking about police officers.
Yeah.
Okay. I get that. We're not talking about police officers killing black people tonight, though. We are just talking about black people as victims, whoever is on the perpetrator's side. Okay, because you had me lost just a little bit. But yeah, we're talking. But it's okay. Yeah. And I appreciate that. And as a matter of fact, tomorrow, just a little plug, we will be talking about the Trayvon Martin documentary, where I would like for you to call in again, because we are going to be talking about that and some other issues surrounding Black Lives Matter, the beginning of that process. But Emmanuel, thank you so much. Let me go to Nicole. Nicole calling from D.C. What's on your mind?
Hi, yes. I definitely thank you all for bringing this matter up. But one of the questions that I do have is more so around the socioeconomic status and the different disparities across economics in general, and whether there was an increase for the amount of unsolved Black deaths in communities that weren't as affluent. I feel like, you know, of course, race always matters, but when you follow the money speaks just as loud sometimes. So I just wonder what the studies showed for that.
Well, he spoke specifically about cities. He did not so much touch on some of the economic issues, but he did talk specifically about cities, urban centers. And if you haven't had a chance to read the article, I would certainly recommend that you do. I would also invite you to listen to this after the break, because we will be talking about solutions as well. And we will hear once again from reporter Wesley Lowry. So, Nicole, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our discussion about the Washington Post article, Murder with Impunity and Unequal Justice, looking at why Blacks are murdered more than whites in America, but the crimes are less likely to be solved. Of course, the lead investigative reporter on that article is Wesley Lowry. And I asked him today about solutions to the issues that were brought out as a result of the article. And this is what he shared with me.
You know, police leaders, homicide detectives, homicide commanders stress that they really do want to solve these homicides, and I believe them. I think that many of these departments are working really hard to be better at this. You know, there are any number of things that gets talked about. Chiefly, a lot of folks talk about them just needing to build stronger relationships in their most violent neighborhoods because they know someone knows something about these homicides, and they have to be able to convince those people to talk to them. Beyond that, there are some questions about resources. How much is each department spending on this type of investigation versus how much are they spending on other things? Are there enough detectives? Are those detectives being deployed correctly at the right time in the right way?
April, back to the snitching issue, and you said it needs to be buried. I agree, but I also argue that it is easier said than done. So my question to you is, whose responsibility is it to bury that snitching gets stitches mentality when you're talking about a Black community that is non-monolithic in its individual urban cultures? We can have, you know, extremely well-educated, affluent African-Americans who may be more likely, because of quality of life in their community, to call the police and to say, this is what I saw. And then you have some of the underserved urban communities where, you know, you may have crime just outside of your door and the perpetrator just outside of your door. So how do you bury it when the fear is there?
The onus still has to be on law enforcement. You are not going to get me to say under any circumstances that the victims or those who are underserved or those who are most marginalized have any responsibility with respect to this, right? So the key is to have law enforcement show by practice, you know, walk the walk,
right.
Show that if someone comes forward, that person will be protected if necessary, and that, you know, if the information is good, of course, that you will use that information to get an arrest, right? And the arrest is truly only the first part of it, because then the district attorney or the prosecutor has to decide whether that person is going to be charged and for what, and or you may need to go to a grand jury. So an arrest sometimes isn't enough, but it still may give some peace of mind to the victims' families. You know, and there are ways to have coalitions between faith-based groups and law enforcement and community leaders to have these discussions about being more open about what people see and when and how it can be reported. So perhaps someone can go to their pastor, right, and tell them what they saw, and then the pastor can pass on that information, as opposed to there being a direct line until that trust has been reestablished.
During the days of the war on drugs, police departments used to work covertly with citizens in neighborhoods to be stationed in their house, to watch from their house for drug dealing taking place in the community, and protected the citizens. It was all confidential. It was also confidential to the extent that those individuals didn't have to go to court if they met certain standards related to what they were doing, and the police protected them doing it. If they were able to do that, but see, if you paid attention to what I said, it was in the interest of the police and the war on drugs. It wasn't a community thing. So what we're talking about here and what April is raising is that there are processes that go through where if citizens really felt protected, mm-hmm. and there was a product of it, then they would participate in the process. But come on, Nance, it is. Mm-hmm. I strongly believe that the police have more of a responsibility to this than the citizens do or the victim. You can't blame the victim mm-hmm. in this process. Police are providing the public safety services, not the citizens. It's not the reverse. It's the police providing that service.
So as Wesley suggested, is this, Ngozi, an issue of allocation of resources to make sure that citizens feel protected? And I'm not just talking about boots on the ground, police in the community, but I'm talking about down the road mm-hmm. as after you say that's who I saw mm-hmm. and that person is behind bars and that person has friends and you can be protected from that person's friends as well.
And I think that the question about services, I think we need to bring up victim services generally in this conversation. So, under the Obama administration, there was some effort because we looked at the victim services nationally and where people were actually being served. And there was a consideration that Black victims, even though, as we've seen, that they're, you know, more likely to be homicide victims, et cetera, were not actually getting the services that they needed. So if we think about those family members and how they're actually being treated from day one, that's a crucial part of ensuring that you're actually built, continuing to have a relationship with the community. So that's about the police. It's about the prosecutor's office and the way that they actually are keeping people involved in the case, that they're actually letting people know what's going on, that they're actually, treating them as people who have been harmed and undergone serious trauma. And unfortunately, there are times when people whose family members have been victimized are feeling like they are being treated like they're a suspect, or that they're really not being seen as human beings. So I think that that is a really important part of allocation of resources. It's not just about police resources, but it's about overall, how do we treat Black victims of crime and their family members?
April, is this, with all of the information and all of the publicity and protests and kneeling and everything else, why are we still seeing this divide? Do we need a wholesale cultural education when it comes to not just policing, but I think in investigating murders in the Black community?
Yes, we do. But that education has to happen for law enforcement, right? Not for the communities that they serve. I mean, when you have the president of this country not understanding why NFL players are kneeling to, in fact, protest the treatment of Black and brown people in this country at the hands of police, and not because they're disrespecting the flag or the veterans, it has to start at the top. And if he can't get it, then why should we expect any sheriff or law enforcement official on a community or city level to get it? So absolutely, there has to be a re-education. And Black people and brown people and marginalized people have been screaming this from the rooftops for decades. You know, this didn't start with Colin Kaepernick. This didn't start with Trayvon Martin. This didn't start with MLK. You know, since this country was founded, on the backs of African people and those who were enslaved, we have had issues with respect to law enforcement, right? You know, KRS-One will tell you it's gone from overseer to officer, right? Yeah, but not much has changed except for a few letters there. So absolutely, there has to be retraining. There has to be re-education. Let's talk about de-escalation techniques. Why are you pulling your gun as opposed to pulling a bully club, right? Why are you considering lethal force at the your first option as opposed to your last?
And maybe you shouldn't even pull a club. Maybe you ought to engage your brain and talk to people and try to de-escalate the situation. But the guy that was on the telephone, Harold, had made a good point when he talked about the police chief as a lieutenant. That was individual behavior. Mm-hmm. But what we're talking about is the culture of the institution, as well as the other institutions that in the sexuality takes place with the criminal justice system and policing in this country. Mm-hmm. There's a culture that allows that to happen, and the manifestation or the results of it is what we see in the homicide rates versus the closure rates and across the board. So we got good individuals, but is the institution itself, is the institutional culture providing for us what it is that we need as a race of people?
Speaking of Chief Newsom, a couple of months ago, Chief Newsom instituted as part of this cultural training and whatever, he sent officers to the African American Museum, the new museum. But we are
not new. It should.
But here's my point. These police officers, you have to be 21.
You have
to be 21.
Right.
But at the same time, most of these officers, men and women, they are well into their adult years. How do you balance the injection of cultural education when many officers are hardwired to their thoughts already about what's happening in the black community, even black officers?
Well, I would suggest that when we find one that's hardwired and he can't change, then we need to get rid of him.
But do we find that out when it's too late sometimes?
Oh, I believe that there are indications along the way that say that what they do is think that it's going to change, or somehow or another that a 2 or 3 days of training is going to change that hard wire that you described. It's not going to change. So we need to get rid of them. And then we need to get rid of those who demonstrate a behavior that we shouldn't tolerate. Then we need to get rid of them,
and
because it provides for two things: a deterrent for that individual, as well as a deterrent for those who would even attempt to do it. And we don't do that.
I think early intervention programs have been shown, where you're saying if there's a small situation, right, this is not where somebody lost their life, but there's disrespect, there are other issues that you can intervene early. We can also say that we know that people's kind of those kind of undercover assumptions about people are affecting their behavior. Dr. Philippa Tiva Goff did a great study about how people who had kind of problems just instinctually seeing black people as human beings, see them as more close to animals, also had higher records of excessive force. Now, when you figure those folks out, you need to be doing something about that. But I would also just say that this bigger picture perspective has to be about our ideas about preventing violence in the first place. We are in the middle of a public health crisis, not a crisis that's all about locking people up, but a public health crisis when we have the homicide rates that we do, and we need to be addressing that holistically.
I think we need to stop it right there. I am out of time, but I do want to thank Nguzi Ndulue, as well as April Rain and Ron Hampton, for participating in this conversation. We needed an extra hour. This is such a critical conversation, but we are going to continue to address issues like this on this program. So again, thank you all so much for participating with us. That is The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Tuesday, July 31st. I'm Harold Fisher. You can tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Now stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.